So, hello. My name is Adi, Dr. Adi Manna, Professor Shifra Segui is lost somewhere, but I hope that she will join us soon. We are very happy to be with you in this symposium about salutogenesis in global pandemic. I would like to share the screen with you. Just a minute. Now you see all my presentations. So, okay, here it is. Okay. So the symposium is about order out of chaos, salutogenesis in global pandemic. Our agenda is we have four presentations, 10 minutes each. The presenters will describe their interesting studies from different social contexts. And we hope the integration between the studies could illuminate the relationship between individual and collective coping resources during the COVID-19 crisis. If you will have any question, please write it down in the Q&A box in the chat. The session will be recorded, so you can decide if you wish to open your camera or not. We will be very happy to see your kind faces. Okay, so let's start. The first presentation is Order Out of Chaos. In this presentation, we would like to share with you the main results of an international research project and a longitudinal study conducted in time of the COVID-19 pandemic. We will mainly focus on the role of salutogenic factors that create order out of chaos and promote mental health during the pandemic. So, as many of you, on March 2020, Shifra Segui and I suddenly found ourselves in a new and chaotic situation. A feeling that the world is suddenly changing, that an unknown, frightened threat is coming. And since both of us, like most of you, were forced to stay home, we decided to adopt a salutogenic approach and try to strengthen our feeling of comprehensibility while trying to understand what is going on around us, our feeling of manageability while trying to do what we know how to do to explore this unique situation, and strengthens our feeling of meaningfulness, that is to perceive this situation as a unique opportunity that we shouldn't miss to gain new understanding about struggling with the crisis. So since we are members of the Salutogenic Working Group of the IUHPE, we invite our friend to join us to this journey, and gladly many of them felt the same and agreed. And this is our wonderful research team. Few of them are with us in this session. Each researcher distributed the same questionnaire, translated, of course, to the local language via online survey platform or social media networks. So we collected a large international cross-sectional sample from Israel, Italy, Spain, the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, Austria, the Czech Republic, Brazil, and the USA. In several places, there were more than one phases of data collection. And in Israel, we conducted a longitudinal study with five phases. So we have a very good distraction from the crisis. Our studies aim to explore a very interesting question: how do people cope with the COVID-19 and remain mentally healthy? Based on the salutogenic approach, we hypothesize that sense of coherence as well as other coping resources will predict the ability to better cope with the crisis. Antonovsky suggested that sense of coherence is a core coping resource that helps the individual to identify and mobilize relevant resources to cope with stressor and manage tension successfully. So according to this salutogenic hypothesis, we expected that during the stressful period, adults with a strong sense of coherence could find appropriate coping resources in their surrounding and use them efficiently. And by that, they will keep their mental health level and reduce their anxiety. Based on the ecological perspective, we also examined several other relevant coping resources at the level of close circles of family, friends, community, and the national group. So what were the research variables? Mental health was defined according to the World Health Organization as the presence of positive feeling, positive functioning, and refers to how people evaluate their life, but we also explore level of general anxiety. The coping resources were sense of coherence at the individual level, but we also explore sense of coherence at the national level. This concept was developed by us in previous study, mainly in the context of intergroup relations, and it's related to the perception of the national group as manageable, comprehensible, and giving a meaning to its members. We also explore the perception of social support one received from his or her immediate environment, family, friend, community, and the level of trust in the government and in the authorities that are in charge of managing the pandemic. In addition, we explore pathogenic variables such as level of health risk and exposure to the coronavirus, level of financial risk, and other social demographic variables that were found in former study to be relevant, such as gender, education, marital status, and voting pattern. So the main research question were, how do people cope with the pandemic and remain mentally healthy? But we also want to explore what can we learn about the longitudinal coping process during the stressful event that is evolving from acute to chronic stress. Since we have a very, very limited time, I will only share with you the main result. We already published the finding, and you are invited to receive the full manuscript by writing to my email. So the first question, how do people cope with the pandemic and remain mentally healthy? To test this question, we made a separate hierarchical regression to test the role of coping resources, risk factor, and demographic variable in predicting mental health and anxiety. A level of overall regression model predicted more than 50% of the variance in mental health and anxiety in the different countries. In addition, among all samples, the above and above the, all the other coping and risk factor, sense of coherence was the main predictor of mental health and anxiety. The finding confirmed the central role Antonovsky assigned to the sense of coherence as a universal core and major coping resource, not limited by cultural and situational characteristics. And as for the question, how does sense of coherence work? We follow the assumption that strong sense of coherence allow one to be flexible and reach out for appropriate resources, and that this strength, the mental health. And we suggested the social support as a mediating factor between sense of coherence and mental health. And the model was confirmed in all the samples. So it seems that during the COVID-19 period, people with stronger sense of coherence could reach out for more support from their close and distant social circles, and therefore to maintain their mental health. And when we look on the longitudinal study conducted in Israel over the five phases, we found several interesting results. While the level of mental health and coping resources of perceived social support, trust, sense of national coherence significantly and gradually decreased from the first phase to the next four phases of the data collection, the level of sense of coherence remained stable along the five phases of the data collection. In addition, people who reported on higher level of sense of coherence during the outbreak of the pandemic have also higher level of mental health at the end of the year of the pandemic. So, what can we learn from this study? COVID-19 pandemic provide us a unique opportunity to understand how people from different countries and different cultures struggle with the same stressor, a difficult pandemic. Overall, our result confirm Antonovsky hypothesis that the personal construct of sense of coherence is a core and universal protective factor that contribute to effective coping, even in time of widespread health crisis. Strong sense of coherence in stressful period allow one to be flexible and reach out for appropriate resources in his or her surrounding. The main implication of the study is the importance of keeping in mind that in time of crisis, people need to increase their comprehensibility, manageability, and meaningfulness. And we can ask ourselves and our leader, what are the best ways to implement it? So thank you very much for listening. And if you have any question, please write it down in the chat. And our next speaker, Claudia Surado, will describe the study she conducted in Italy. Claudia has a PhD in epidemiology. She is an associated professor in public health at the University of Cagliari in Sardinia, Italy. Her research focuses on health determinants, epidemiology of chronic disease, quality of life and lifestyle, and she would like to integrate the salutogenic approach into health system. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Just a moment, please. Okay. Okay, can you see my slide? Perfect. Okay, thanks for introducing me, Adi. And good afternoon, everyone. I will now present the main results of a survey inspired by the work of Shifra and Adi. This survey was carried out in Italy in collaboration with the Bachelor in Public Health from the University of Cagliari, Milan, Brescia, Florence, and Chieti. And we deal with the topic of COVID-19 vaccination propensity and the role of sense of coherence and the sense of national coherence. We know that vaccination programs are among the major preventive measures to control communicable diseases, but we know also that there is an increasing decline of trust in vaccines that is spreading in several high-income countries. Vaccination attitude is the result of a complex decision-making process influenced by a wide range of factors which may exert different weights and which may also influence each other. We have factors such as historical, social, political, cultural determinants, or personal experience with vaccine, health belief, risk and benefit perception, and also technological determinants such as the introduction of a new vaccine. And in this historical period, we had a new disease, and here we had new vaccines. And in Italy, institutional stakeholders, so politicians and experts in the public health, even before a vaccine was available, expressed concern that the growing mistrust in vaccination could affect the propensity towards COVID vaccination. So in accordance with the salutogenic perspective, we decided to focus on COVID vaccination propensity in order to explore the role of sense of coherence and sense of national coherence. Our research question were mainly if SOC and SONG are associated with COVID vaccination propensity, do they constitute assets toward this vaccination? And we also explore how do they relate with the other factors that affect vaccination propensity. So we carried out a survey using an online questionnaire that was spread in two different periods. First period from July to October 2020, when no COVID vaccine was available. And the second period was between December and January 2021, when vaccination officially started in Europe. Our work was based on a convenience sampling, and approximately 100 students spread the questionnaire's link to their friends and relatives, asking them to answer and to spread the questionnaire. And more than 5,000 Italian people filled in the questionnaire. 43% expresses propensity to COVID vaccination, more specifically 37% in the first period when no vaccine was available, and about 60% in the second period after the vaccination starting. In order to explore factors associated with the COVID vaccination propensity, a multivariate logistic regression was performed, and gender, age, education level, COVID vaccine availability, flu vaccine propensity, COVID danger perception, SOC, SONG, and their first order interactions were considered as the independent variable. The logistic regression highlights that all explored factors, with the exception of gender, were significantly associated with the COVID vaccination propensity. And each factor acts in interaction with at least one other factor. So the effect of each factor on COVID vaccination propensity changes depending on the value of one or more other factors. But now we can focus on the effect of SOC adjusted for the other factors considered in the model. We found that SOC acts in interaction with age. We can say that SOC acts modulating the effects of age. In fact, among people with low SOC means SOC lower than 50. Among people with low SOC, those over 60 years old were significantly less likely to be inclined to get vaccinated than those between 40 and 60 years old. While among people with high SOC, age becomes an irrelevant factor, and in over 60, the likelihood of vaccination is overlapping with that of younger person. This result seems consistent with both salutogenesis theory and innovation theory. We know that older people tend to be less accepting of innovations, and COVID-19 vaccines are an innovation. However, I thought which translate in a better ability to stay out, to cope with the pandemic situation, and probably allows these people to overcome their natural distrust of novelty. Now focus on the effect of song. Song acts in interaction with the COVID danger perception. Consequently, among people with a low COVID danger perception, song does not affect COVID vaccination attitude, while among people with a high COVID danger perception, those with high song are twice as likely to get vaccinated as those with low song. In Italy, the COVID vaccination was strongly promoted by national government, so we hypothesized that high song may help people most worried about the effects of the pandemic to perceive this vaccine as an asset. And using the coefficients of the logistic model, we estimated the probability of COVID vaccines propensity according to a different combination of the several factors included in the model. And as you can see at a glance, by looking at the pink colored cells, for each possible combination of factors, in people with the high SOC, the negative effect of age disappear, and the probability of COVID vaccination propensity in over 60 become overlapping or higher than those observed to those observed in people aged between 40 and 59. And similarly, for in people who perceive high COVID danger perception, the probability of COVID vaccine propensity is higher in those with high sense of national coherence than in those with low sense of national coherence. In summary, our result support the hypothesis that the SOC and SONC affect the COVID vaccine propensity and could be an asset for COVID vaccine propensity. The size of SOC and SONC effects may seem small compared to those of the other considered factors. On average, it's about 10%, but small does not mean irrelevant. In fact, as in all complex phenomena, even in the case of COVID vaccine attitude, small effects in a complex intertwining of several factors can lead at population level to a relevant shift in the hesitation propensity continuum. And thank you for your attention, and thank you to Shifra and Adi for that were the source of inspiration for this world, and thank you to the students who collaborated to this study.
And thank you, Claudia, for joining us in this research. I think Italy was almost the first country that joined our research on Europe. And I remember the situation was very bad. First, I need to apologize that I joined you only now. I had a long way to go from the previous session about the stories of Antonovsky, and they took me time to arrive here. Anyway, I'm here now, and I will join Adi in moderating this session. And our next speakers are actually only Leah is here, Dr. Leah Mandel, who joined also Dr. Lisa Hardy. And she will talk about the study they conducted in the United States. Lisa is still sleeping now in Arizona, but Leah is here. And Dr. Hardy is a medical anthropologist who focuses on collaborative research strategies and implementation plans in public health. She is also editor of the journal Practicing Anthropology. she will present today is a cultural, what I said before, it's about Lisa, and now about Leah. Dr. Mandel is a cultural anthropologist who works on issues of immigrant integration and community-based research. Leah, please.
Thank you so much. I'm just going to share my screen. Oops. Sorry. So thank you. As Shifra said, and good to see everyone here. I've been working with Lisa Hardy on this study. We are both faculty at Northern Arizona University. And Lisa is very much the PI on this study, but I've been very excited to work with her on data collection and also analysis and writing a bit. And it really was a collaborative effort as well with Adi and Sharon Benheim and Shifra, and then also Kayla Morales, who was on our paper as well. So this is a mixed methods study. And as you'll see, that mixed methods approach was really essential to identifying areas for research and actually carrying it out. It was also a mixed theoretical approach. So Adi and Sharon and Shifra were bringing the salutogenic lens. Actually, salutogenesis is new to Lisa and to me. So we've learned a great deal through this process. We were approaching the project more through the lens of critical medical anthropology. We administered the same survey. We had actually already started with interviews back in March. Lisa began those interviews. And at the time that we wrote this paper, had completed 50 in-depth interviews, semi-structured. And we administered the survey twice. This project is referring to the first iteration of the survey, which was administered in May and June of 2020 with 500 responses around the US. And we then redid the survey in December and January, and hopefully we'll be discussing that more in future papers. So it was really a back and forth between the quantitative and the qualitative research starting in March, as I said, and the quantitative analysis led us both to look back at the qualitative results from the interviews we had already conducted, and also to keep in mind the questions that were raised by the quantitative research as we continued with our interviews. I just want to acknowledge that while this was a really interesting and important research opportunity for all of us, also many of us have lost friends and relatives to the coronavirus. Others are suffering long-term effects, either of the disease itself or of effects to their livelihood. And we just want to thank all of the participants who engaged with us about their experience. So as we began to look at responses to our questionnaire, first of all, we noticed that about half of our participants were women who identified as left-leaning politically. That was either Democrat or progressive or socialist. They expressed that in different ways. This was back in May and June. They saw themselves as very much in opposition to the federal government at the time in the United States. And rather than try to compensate for that, we decided to really delve in and try to understand the experiences of these left-leaning women. Adi and Sharon explored the relationships between their coping resources and their mental health and anxiety. And then we then delved back into our interviews with people who identified similarly as left-leaning women to understand their experience. So there were some interesting and somewhat unexpected quantitative results. We saw that sense of coherence and social support did significantly predict mental health, but sense of national coherence and trust were not significant as predictors of mental health. Similarly, SOC significantly predicted levels of general anxiety, but sense of national coherence and social support and trust didn't. And then in terms of trust, looking at legal courts, police, government, economy, and media, these were all related to a strong SOC and SONC and better mental health. But trust in national level institutions, particularly the president, but also the CDC, hospitals, healthcare providers, those were less relevant and they didn't correlate with levels of mental health and anxiety. So we wanted to try to explore more about these low levels of trust of SONC didn't lead to higher levels of anxiety for women. Just to give you a bit of a sense of the level of mistrust that women spoke about, it was very high. So not only did they personally feel unsafe, they also felt concern about the health and safety of other people in the country and around the world and the place of the United States in global response to the pandemic. There were multiple references to Nazism, as one respondent said, a second Hitler, Trump is not far from that. I am not safe. My kids are not safe. And that's scary. Really, really, really scary. Someone that has lived free for her whole life has something like this coming up in her head. So this is just one example of the real level of fear and mistrust that our respondents expressed. But what we saw is that this anxiety about both the national and international responses to the pandemic was mitigated very much through new forms of connection and enhanced forms of old connections. So many of those were real. So they were working on their own relationships in their households, as you can see in the quote on the bottom left. Who knew after 50 years of marriage, you could think of new ways to think about something. People were exploring their positive relationships in their homes, but people were also reaching out, of course, as we all did, as we're doing right now, through forms of technology to connect with people. Dance parties, happy hours, writing, prayer groups, people shared many, many different ways that they were forming new forms of connection. We also saw networks of care. And we saw that many of our participants moved back and forth between being caregivers and receiving care. They talked about developing friendships with people who reached out to help them and then reciprocating through delivering food and other connections. We also saw symbolic connections that people spoke about drawn from the imagined experiences of others. And so some people were comforted by the fact that they were experiencing the same thing as others around the world. They saw themselves as connected, even though they didn't know those people. And others really acknowledged their own privilege, the ways they saw themselves as different from those throughout the world who were being affected more intensely by the virus. But they seemed to acknowledge that as a form of connection itself, being able to empathize with those around the world. We also know, though, that women and also likely other non-male genders who are performing roles of caretaking and connection do have an increased risk of exposure. And we've seen other research that has documented that these kinds of activities and approaches that women found to be powerful coping mechanisms, especially the direct care, of course, might put participants at greater risk of contracting the virus. Women are more likely to be frontline caregivers and therefore have to be in those positions. And also sometimes they sought it out. So they definitely, our respondents spoke about the limitations on their ability to care for others and their frustration that they couldn't have those kinds of that close proximity and physical interaction that they wanted to have. So some implications, certainly the potential is for public health professionals and others to support these kinds of enhanced connections, especially for people who see themselves as living in opposition to a federal government or to the kinds of institutions that otherwise we might see as protective. We do see, as Adi said at the beginning, this connection and cohesion, reducing anxiety, increasing mental health, even for people who did not have a strong sense of national coherence, who saw themselves as living in opposition. And then just the generativity, creativity that we saw across our respondents to this pandemic, even though they weren't feeling supported federally. In terms of further research, we had a pretty limited way of analyzing gender here. We know that gender is a much more complicated category and intersectional category than we were really able to explore in our quantitative analysis. We'd like to take a much more fine-grained approach to that. And also thinking about gendered assumptions of caregiving more explicitly, how people experience those. We're also talking now about coming back to those left-leaning women now that their relationship to the federal government may have changed with a new administration in the United States, or not, perhaps. Here are a few of the publications that are coming out, and please feel free to get in touch if you have additional questions or want access to any of those. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Leah. And now we are going to our next presenter, who is Dr. Michael Sternberg. Dr. Sternberg is a postdoctoral fellow at the Martin Springer Center for Conflict Studies in our university, Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. And his areas of studies are on personal and collective coping resources during crisis, social crisis, and also about peace education and the contribution of action research to social transformation initiatives. So Michael will present his qualitative research about this, the part of qualitative research in our study. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Shifra. And your disclosure, I'm a student of Shifra for quite a few years, and I plan to keep it that way for quite a few more years. And the study I present, need to go to the beginning. The study I present is a joint study. And to add to the personal, it definitely helped me to make sense of my experience of Israeli society in the times of the pandemic. And it added very interesting conversations between Shifra and me, trying to figure out what do we learn about the responses to the pandemic among people who have critical dispositions towards the government at that time. And a bit about the study context. Now it seems obvious, I think, many of the things that I present here. It was a time throughout 2019 when we had the study, 20. So many of the things that that were happening were not only about the medical. It was not only about health, it was about the experience of a society in upheaval and the individual community and the national level. And specifically within Israel, it was a time that in many ways resonates what we just heard from Leah. It was a time of deep political distrust. We didn't have a functioning government, we still don't have. And we had like lots of interim governments, and it added to the general sense of chaos. In this study, we explored individuals' perceptions of the personal and of the societal challenges and the potential interrelation between these two, and focusing on individuals who were critically disposed towards the government at the time, we asked, so what were the experiences of the potential relationship between the person and the societal challenge? And in addition to this, so what were their coping resources for addressing the challenges they experienced? It's a qualitative study. It was based on Zoom-based interviews. And in a way, it was an ongoing conversation with 15 participants. Starting in March, April 2020, when we had the first national lockdown in Israel, and with follow-up in conversations, it was more conversations than interviews, I think, during August, September, when we had an increase of the COVID-19, and at the same time, an increasing political and societal turbulence. Throughout these conversations, I invited the interviewers to share their thoughts, their emotions, their way of making sense of their experiences. And who were those people? There were people who had a rich personal history of public engagement as academics, as professionals, as community leaders. And most of them were self-defined leftists, critical of the government, which in the Israeli context is a minority population. And people who had a long career, they were from their early 50s to their, from their late 50s to their early 70s. People well experienced in life and in the experience of diverse types of crisis in Israeli society. Starting with the findings. First of all, what was the experience like of the COVID-19 crisis? I rushed through it because I think much of it came through already in Adi's presentation and also in Leah's. Life as we know it stopped. This is like the first theme. And I think every one of us can relate to that, being restricted on the very routines of life and realizing what we take for granted, all of a sudden it doesn't. Even if I'm, as a professional person, if I'm see myself very much engaged in more work, so what does it imply when I have to stay at home? Getting along with those people who live with me at home. There was any, for this specific group of people, there was also a feeling of stigmatization. All of a sudden, I'm a population at risk because of my age. Does this define me? A challenge and a blessing. It was a time for reckoning. Like all of a sudden, because the daily routine stopped, it was also a time to think about, so what is my life about? What is of importance to me? What is less so? In response to the question, to what degree do I perceive COVID-19 primarily as a health crisis, the overarching response was, it's not so much a health crisis. There's a health crisis, but the major crisis is how our society coping with it, or maybe not coping with it. And the experience was very personal. For people with a concrete political outlook, critical of the current, of the then government, it felt like a personal threat. There was real fear of a country deteriorating from a liberal democracy to something which is very similar to what Leah described before, dictatorship. And it was a lonely place to be in. Outside of societal consensus, it's a struggle, it's a personal struggle. So in a way, the bottom line of what I describe here is that the experience of societal chaos in the context of the pandemic is a great challenge to the sense of personal coherence. Which brings me to the coping resources. First things first, family and friends, very much like what was described in the quantitative study. These were very important of creating a sense of grounding, of being able to cope with things. Being close to those that are close to me is a great source of coping. Little do I know, I find this very fascinating, the acceptance that things are so complex and so unpredictable, which is, I think, one of the great experiences that we had during the COVID-19. It challenges our cognitive capacity. And in a way, this radical acceptance that I can't know so many things, there are so many unknowns involved and I have to accept it and deal with it. And this is my map. This is quite interesting, I think. True to myself, like when I'm lonely in my position and life is unpredictable, what guides me are my very personal values. Walk on paths, less travel, meaning finding that to be an outside voice is a value in itself. It's not a punishment in a way, it's a privilege by itself. It's to be a pioneer. My acts matter, meaning I realize I won't change this complex reality, but I can walk the talk. I can behave according to the values and the directions I think that matter. And keeping up the capacity for curiosity and hope. If not being downtrodden, it's being able to look ahead with a sense of things might surprise me also for the better, not only for the worse. Here are some of the quotes that we're having here. The one I particularly like is the fourth one. When I was hiking with my daughter, she asked me, why don't I follow the mountain paths? Why do I look for other ways up to the mountains? I told her, choosing paths others have not taken yet is more of a challenge and more of a value. And this was a metaphor for behavior during the COVID-19. 2 minutes of conclusions. I think we very much see that the key concept of SOC, SOC, really captures the challenges of the experiences of the pandemic, our capacity to retain a sense of comprehensibility, manageability, and meaningfulness in times of unpredictability, and a strong sense of coherence in such times might mean a consideration of my personal values, the intention, attention to interpersonal relationships and commitments, and the readiness to actively adapt to life affected by new types of restrictions and directives beyond the individual's direct control, in a way, agility. And I think what we also find here, and this resonates, I think, what we heard before with Leah, the experience of political challenge is a challenge in itself, which demands great sense of coherence and readiness to cope with what we experience as a political threat. And potentially, when we have a low sense of national coherence, we need a very strong sense of personal coherence in order to cope with this experience. And I think this might be one of the more interesting outcomes. Also on a theoretical level, what is the relationship between low sense of national coherence and strong sense of personal coherence? Potentially, the more we have a sense of personal coherence, individual coherence, we are more ready to disengage towards the national sense of coherence. So engaging with the experiences of political threat from positions that are attuned to comprehensibility, manageability, or meaningfulness, what does it mean? It's making sense of the complex societal dimensions of the crisis, identifying feasible individual paths of action deemed of value, and finding meaning in one's position as a critical voice contributing to a desired societal future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mikhail, very much. And now we are coming to the end, to the last presentation of Mary Abuhanna. And she will talk about her research among Palestinians in the West Bank who live in the Palestinian Authority. And Mary did this research in a difficult conditions, and we appreciate it very much. And she will, she is a PhD doctoral student at Ben Gurion University. I'm glad to be her mentor. And she is also a school psychologist in East Jerusalem and is interested in researching coping resources which help individuals and groups to maintain mental health, especially in conflict zone like we are living in, such as Israel and Palestine. Mary, please.
Thank you, Shifra, very much. So as Shifra said, I did this research in difficult circumstances because it was lockdown times and we had to do the questionnaires on online platforms. So today I will be talking about the individual and the collective national resources which helped Palestinian in West Bank and East Jerusalem to cope with the corona pandemic. So employing the salutogenic approach, the purpose of the study was really to find out the different patterns of coping resources in different periods of time that Palestinians used in order to deal with the COVID-19 virus and to stay healthy.
We don't hear you well, Mary.
No?
Come closer maybe to the microphone.
Okay. So I was saying that employing the salutogenic approach, it was the purpose of the study was really to find out the different coping patterns that Palestinians had and used in order to cope with the COVID-19 pandemic. And the question was about two periods of time. The first period of time was during the beginning of the pandemic when it was an acute stress situation. And the second period of time where I passed the questionnaires was characterized by a chronic stress situation. So the acute stress really describes the first period of the coronavirus where it was very novel and people didn't know how to deal with it. But the chronic time, after a few months, it was something that is more familiar, that people get used to it somehow, and they knew how to cope with it in a different way. So I have to note first that the context of the study is very important because it's done in the West Bank, especially where Palestinians really face different circumstances economically, socially, and also politically. And it really affects their mental health and well-being in general. So they are living under chronic stress situation most of the time. Because of the Israeli occupation and other different circumstances that they have here that could really make their experience of living very, very tough, very hard. They are also prone to develop different kinds of mental health disorders, post-traumatic depression, anxiety. Because living in a conflict zone, as Shifra said, it's the place where we have interactable conflict, which is very intense and was been for a very long time. And it can be tremendously harmful for individuals. So it can have health and mental health implications, but at the same time, research shows that the percentage of people that reported long-term serious mental damages were really low. So this research is different because it's asked from a salutogenic approach and not pathogenic. So the spread of coronavirus was considered an acute stress situation adding to the chronic stress one. So as I said, the data collection was conducted in two periods of time via online platforms. The first period was May 2020, and the second period of time was August 2020. So at May 2020, as I said, it's considered an acute stress situation adding to the chronic stress state. And in August, it was the chronic stress situation, but without the acute stress one. The sample at the first period included 257 participants. And at the second time, it included 188 participants. Accordingly, according to the model of Shifra-Sagi from 2002, I expected that personal and national resources would explain mental health better at the second period of time, because it's only chronic stress, and according to the salutogenic theory, it's more similar to daily life experience. So sense of personal coherence and sense of national coherence would explain mental health in a better way at the second time of passing the questionnaires. And as you can see here, according to the results, sense of personal coherence was relatively stable. It didn't change over time, but sense of national coherence really decreased over time significantly. Mental health also was stable, but anxiety increased from the first period to the second period in a significant way. And as part of analyzing the results, I had to look at the correlations between those three variables in the different periods where I passed the questionnaires. So as you can see, at the first period, there were lower correlations relatively to the second period where I passed the questionnaires. And it really supports the hypothesis that the correlation was higher. So maybe people used these coping resources better at the second time, when it was August and not in the beginning of the pandemic. And the linear regression showed that sense of personal coherence explained mental health at the first wave and also at the second wave. But the sense of national coherence explained the mental health only at the beginning of the pandemic, at the first wave. But at the second wave, it wasn't that significant. So the correlations also, we can see that the correlation between sense of personal coherence and sense of national coherence was much higher at the second period. And it could mean that they became more similar variables. And in this interaction diagram, it also shows that people with high sense of personal coherence and high sense of national coherence had higher levels of mental health at the second time than at the first time, which means that they could use these coping resources in a better way at the second wave. So the findings support the hypothesis partially, because it shows that the personal sense of coherence explained mental health better during the second period of time of this research, because it was chronic stress situation, which is more similar to daily life. And daily life of Palestinians in the West Bank, which experience stress on a daily basis. But sense of national coherence, which was a relevant resource only at the first period of time. This could mean that the sense of national coherence was explained mental health and was higher at the first period because people expected the national institutions to deal properly with the crisis of COVID-19. But when they didn't deal with it properly, I think that sense of national coherence decreased and the sense of personal coherence increased. So the pandemic turned from a national struggle into a more collective, into a more personal struggle. And thank you very much.
Okay, so thank you very, very much, Mary. Now, I didn't get questions, but I would like to open it to your question, or and if not, I will ask something. Anyone want to ask something? Okay. Thank you, Ruta, for the feedback.
Adi, I'd love to ask Mikhail.
Yes.
Just the way you framed this question at the end about the relationship between sense of coherence and sense of national coherence, that you know, that perhaps a stronger sense of personal coherence might lead you to be able to disengage. Well, I don't know if you meant lead you to be able to disengage or lead you to be able to cope with a sense of opposition or disengagement with the nation. I'd just love to hear a little bit more about how you're thinking about that, and also for others who have dealt with this these questions in a salutogenic way, if there are other ways we could be thinking about it, because clearly, as you say, we have very similar kinds of responses that we've gotten.
Actually, I think we just defined our next research layer. what directions do they go? The SOC and SONC. For me, it's a bit the chicken and the egg issue, what comes first. But there are some indications that it goes together. I think especially in a very... In a society which delegitimizes deviation from from national narratives, from support of the political leadership, it demands very much personal courage. It really makes you experience you're entering a danger zone. It might be not only social danger, it might even become physical danger. And in that sense, you need to have a very strong sense of personal coherence in order to be able to live through such an experience and be okay with it, survive it mentally. And find me. So if you don't find meaning in that position, if you're not guided by a mental cognitive map, a value map, and if you don't have a sense of personal resources, it might become a very challenging situation. Maybe Shifa can add something to it because we discussed it quite a bit.
we talked about it a lot, Michael, yes. Sense of coherence is very personal and you develop it. However, it's not developed by yourself. It's developed by the context that you are living in and the conditions that you are living in. And what we found all the time is that this is very stable orientation, how you look at the world. Sense of national coherence, it's much, and we don't know if your own sense of coherence influence how you look at your national or not. But as Michael said, what we found in the interviews was that if you have a strong sense of coherence, you can allow yourself not to have a strong sense of national coherence. But it's better that you have both as resources to get mental health. But there are times, like in your country and like in our country and in Brazil, I saw Hiruta, when the crisis is so difficult that you cannot rely on your sense of national coherence. And you don't expect also to rely on it. So you use much more your personal and your small community. We didn't speak about it, but the first concept that I developed after the sense of the personal sense of coherence, this was my dissertation under the supervision of Aaron, but I was a family therapist, and I told him we must examine the family sense of coherence. The family sense of coherence is a very strong resource that helps you also to cope. And maybe we need to find out. Now we are looking together with Michael and Adi. We are going to another concept of sense of professional coherence. So there are different areas that you can use your sense of coherence. Different areas, and it is not always the same area. But the personal, what we found and what Adi presented so well, and also Mary and Michael, everyone, and also you, is that the personal sense of coherence is the orientation to life, is the basic source that you rely on. And all the others are less strong in predicting mental health, if that's what you are looking for. I hope I understand your question, and I tried to answer it as much as I understood it.
Thank you, Shifra. And I think Gonda, Shifra answered your question also. Gonda, I can see you here.
Sorry, yes, I'm.
Yes.
Yes, a little bit. It's my struggle the whole time. It's very nice to use a sense of coherence, but and I see it a lot in research, but the most important thing is, can we influence sense of coherence? Because yes, there most of the researchers they can say yes, a strong sense of coherence leads to strong mental health, etc. But what can we do as a health professional?
Yes, that's the big question. How can we strengthen sense of coherence of people? That's what you are asking, yes?
Yes, yes. And I understand it's about meaningfulness, or it's comprehensible, or yes, manageable. Make the lives more manageable, make the lives more meaningful. That's what I am thinking now.
Yes, so we... my last research with Antonovsky was about this question, how people develop the sense of coherence. We interviewed the people with strong SOC and with a low SOC, weak SOC, and we interviewed their life story. And from the life story, we tried to see what happened to them during the years. Some of them were Holocaust survivors. It was many years ago.
I know, yes.
So you read it about this.
Yes, I know. but the same question is always...
what happened to them? Yes. So there are several papers. I can't answer it about all this. There are several papers, and also Antonovsky wrote about it, and I wrote about it later on. So there are several experiences in life that that can predict that your sense of coherence will be stronger. One of them is stability, for example, and another of them is the connection between the community and the family and the child. Good connection. The other one is, for example, that the family has strict rules. That this is not usual now in this period. But but it's not the discipline. It's that the child knows what is right and what is wrong. There are values to the family, and several other experiences that we found in this research of interviews of life stories. We found them as contributing to strong sense of coherence. I can't now detail everything, but there are some papers, and I think that we need more research about this question. I think most of the research in the area of salutogenesis is going how sense of coherence is predicting health or predicting mental health. And few research asking the question that you asked, about how can we develop strong sense of coherence?
Yes, because if the first thought was the sense of coherence is stable, it's just like a characteristic of a person, like his gender or something like that. But later on, I read some research that the sense of coherence is not so stable. So when it is not so stable, then it's very interesting concept, because then we can maybe influence it, but we have to know the interventions. What can we do as a person himself or as a health professional to stimulate a more strong?
Yes, that's exactly what was my conversations with Aaron. Aaron, okay, was a sociologist, and he was very strongly believed that sense of coherence is not changing age 30. And I told him all the time, I'm a psychologist, so I need to leave my profession. I have nothing to do.
Yes.
So he said, no, we shall find something. But okay, he didn't believe very much in this direction, but I believe more. So, but we need to find out more. I think we need to do more studies relating to this question, which is...
Yes. It would be very nice if we can do something in the concepts of meaningful and comprehensible and measurable, because that are concepts. We can do something. You can help a person to make his life more meaningful. And then we have to look at his sense of coherence. So that would be very nice research. Maybe we can do it together. Who knows?
You are welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have only 1 minute, but I would like to answer Elia. You wrote in the chat, you asked if there will any connection between sense of coherence and prognosis of disease, and no, there were no connection. Okay. Okay, so I think we the time is over. I hope you enjoyed our symposium. And if you have any question, you can write an email to us. So thank you very, very much. Bye-bye. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Adi.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.